Good afternoon and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and once again, we're live for an hour. This is true each weekday afternoon so that we can have a back and forth conversation with you in real time. You can call in and we can talk. If you have questions about the Bible or the Christian faith that you'd like to raise, we will discuss them. If you have a different take on things than the host has, we can discuss that too. Now, the number to call is 844-484-5737. Now, our lines have just filled up. I believe they're all full right now. So if you call and get a busy signal or get some other indicator from your phone, you know, sometimes when the lines are busy, some cell services give you the signal that the line is not in service or something like that. Different cellular services react differently to finding a busy switchboard. The line is in service. If your phone tells you otherwise, it just means all the lines are full. But if you keep calling, during the course of the program, lines open up all the time, and you can call in and very probably catch an open line if you keep trying. The number again is 844-484-5737. I want to remind our listeners in Northern California that in the middle of May, I'm going to be speaking a few times on eschatological subjects that I've been asked to speak about in Oakhurst. Now, Oakhurst is not a highly populated area, but I don't require there to be much population. I just, if I'm wanted, I usually go. So this area is southwest of Yosemite in California, pretty close to Yosemite, as I understand. And we have bookings, as I'm speaking, on the 13th and 14th of May. That's a Friday and Saturday. Now, my Sunday, which is the 16th, is at this point free, and my wife and I will probably be driving down to Southern California on that day. But if there's anyone between Oakhurst and Southern California that wants to set up, you know, something for me to speak at on the way, we welcome you contacting us. The email would be steve@thenarrowpath.com. All right, let's talk to Richard from Seal Beach, California. Richard, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, Steve, after Luke 4:16, did Jesus still go to the synagogue on the Sabbath day because they tried to kill him? I mean, did he still keep the Sabbath day? And I'll listen to you on the radio.
Okay.
Thanks, Steve.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Well, what you have to understand is there were synagogues in every Jewish town. And Jesus preached all over the country, in every town. And so the synagogue that ran him out and tried to kill him was the synagogue in Nazareth, his hometown. There is evidence that he went back to Nazareth again later in his ministry. There is at least a visit to Nazareth that turned out similarly, mentioned at a later point in a parallel in another gospel. And it would appear that Jesus went to Nazareth twice. And although they didn't kill him the second time or didn't try to anymore, he may not have said anything quite so controversial the second time as he said the first time, but they did not receive him. Now, this, you know, him being run out of the synagogue in Nazareth would not have any impact on his welcome in any other synagogues in other towns. These were not some kind of a chain like McDonald's. They were independent, you know, groups. They weren't fully independent because they're all connected to the temple in Jerusalem. But the leadership of the synagogues was different in every town, and they certainly weren't all on some kind of an email list where they all communicated with each other if they didn't like somebody. So Jesus was able to keep going to synagogues on Saturdays, even though he was rejected in that particular one. And as far as we know, he continued doing so as a policy. I don't know that he did every Sabbath. He may have on some occasions been traveling between towns on some Sabbaths because he moved around a lot. But the Bible indicates his custom was to go into the synagogues and to preach on the Sabbath. So I would say the one you're referring to in Luke chapter 4, that was very early in his ministry. It might even be the first time he preached in Galilee at the beginning of his Galilean ministry. And yet the rest of his Galilean ministry for the next approximately 1 year, he was still going into synagogues a lot. So, you know, the very hostile reception he had there in his own hometown does not necessarily mean that he would not be in synagogues other towns in the future. All right, David from Auburn, Washington, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi there, Brother Steve. Can you hear me all right?
Yes, I can.
Wonderful. So I just have two quick questions for you. I'm driving right now, so I'll make them as fast as I can. My first question for you has to do with I recently started working with a Christian organization, and I was serving there for like half a year out of conviction. But now I've been involved where I'm an employee there now, and I'm part of staff. So now I'm on payroll. My question to you, with that being said, is they have certain quotas for us, and there's paperwork that has to be done. What the ministry does is they go out there, and we serve the homeless people 5-7 nights a week, and you know, food, clothing, things of that nature. And my first question would be, how do I keep that conviction and that fire and zealousness for God? I was kind of overwhelmed when I first started. I had to, you know, do paperwork, reports, and download like 6-7 different apps on my phone, which is kind of like, okay, this is crazy. So yeah, I'm like that. So, but I just wanted that's my first question: how to keep that fire and zealousness for the Lord when I was doing that as a volunteer before I became a staff member. You know,
The fact that you see that as a danger is a good sign that you're aware of it, and you can possibly watch out for that tendency. It is, I think, many people enter ministry of some form. They do begin as volunteers because they just believe in the cause. And because they believe in it, sometimes these organizations, because they have staff, they'll say, hey, we need people who believe in us to work on our staff, so come work for us. And now you're, instead of out helping the homeless, you're up processing paperwork in an office somewhere. You might be doing both, but but it also has the changed dynamic that you are getting some kind of pay for it. Now, I'm not saying that people shouldn't be reimbursed for their work for the Lord, but the fact that you have, let's just say, an employment contract where you're going to work so many hours doing what they tell you to do, and they're going to pay you so much, means it becomes, frankly, I think it becomes impossible in your own mind to divorce the idea that what you're doing is bringing home a paycheck. And I think pastors have this same thing happen. Many times pastors who have very small congregations, they preach for free. Often they'll work in another job, a secular job, and they'll preach for free and serve the church for free because that's where their heart is. And eventually, if the church gets big enough and gives them a nice salary and they can do that full time, although I'm not saying that ruins them necessarily, I'm just saying that suddenly there's a different dynamic. Now this is their job. Now showing up means a paycheck, and that's a very different situation. Now, I'll tell you, all I can say is I have always, from the time I entered the ministry 50 years ago, determined that I would never put myself in that position, that I would never become a paid employee for any religious organization. That doesn't mean that others may not do so. I don't judge others who have it differently, but I knew that there would be that danger. And I thought, well, the easiest thing for me to do is continue to be a volunteer and never charge and continue to do what I feel a passion for. And, if someone wants to do paperwork and that's what they really want to do and they have a passion for that, let them be the paid employee to do it, or let them volunteer to do it if they want to. But the thing is, I believe that I believe it's desirable. Let me just not, I don't want to make this a moral issue, but I believe it's desirable that everyone who works in ministry do it as a volunteer. That doesn't mean they won't be, that God won't provide for them. It doesn't mean that, the ministry won't, out of appreciation, give them something from time to time. Maybe even enough to live on, who knows, from time to time. But the point is, Jesus, no one was paying Jesus when he went around preaching. I mean, he had people who supported him, but he didn't have a paycheck. He didn't show up at the paymaster at the end of each week and say, all right, I worked this many hours. How much do I get? I should get this much back. And the apostles didn't either. And in the early church, even preachers, according to the Didache, a very important church document in the early church, said that if a minister asks for money, he's a false prophet. It was very clear that, as Jesus said, freely you've received, freely give, that the ministers, at least who preach the word, and that may not be the kind of work you're involved in, but the ones who preach the word, they receive that word for free, and they should give it to others for free, Jesus said. So, I mean, it's a I guess today it'd be considered a radical thing, But if radical means going back to the root, because the word radical comes from the word radus, root, if it means going back to the roots of Jesus and the apostles, it is a radical thing, and it's a good thing. But on the other hand, modern Christian organizations have a lot of other kinds of work. Besides people who preach, there's people who, you know, are accountants. There's people who are record keepers. There's people who sit at the front desk as receptionists and things like that. And, I mean, obviously, Christian organizations, I don't think there's any reason why they can't hire people in these positions. But if you're one who worked there for as a passion for free, and now they're paying you and you're afraid, wow, that passion may be eclipsed by a sense of, you know, this is employment. You always can go back to saying, listen, why don't I work for free again? Why don't I just do what I really feel God's leading me to do? And I'll do it for free for Jesus, and I'll trust him to provide for me. And if the organization, you know, happens to see me in need or feel that I'm in need and wants to give something to me once in a while, that's fine. I mean, that's, frankly, I've lived that way for 50 years, never had a guaranteed income from any source, never had a salary from any source, but I have been supported, and I am supported even today by people who just feel like, well, I guess God, I think I just feel led to send something. And so, I mean, I know God will provide in those cases if you're doing what God wants. The main thing is to keep your heart in the right place. And as you've noticed, it is, there's always a possibility that it could change.
Right. Am I still there?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay, cool. My second question for you is, has to do, again, with the ministry I'm working with. We go out 5 nights a week, 7 nights a week. We go and serve the homeless people, you know, food, clothing, chocolate, things of that nature, food. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that's crossed my mind is 2 Thessalonians 3:10 says, hey, if you don't work, you don't eat. And I kind of feel like, huh, are we enabling people out here by doing that every night? And are we doing God's will, or are we kind of stumbling, you know, not stumbling, but are we going against God's will by preventing right. these people to, you know, hit their rock bottom, if that's what they right. say, and, you know, so yeah.
In some cases, no doubt you are enabling them and not doing them that much good, because they are people who really have responsibility to support themselves and should. They might even have families they're failing to support. Somewhere, you know, they may have left their families in order for an, you know, this kind of a irresponsible lifestyle. That wouldn't be true of all of them. I mean, some homeless people truly are disadvantaged. A lot of them, of course, are people who have had mental breakdowns of some sort or another, and they're managed by psychotropic drugs, which disable them further. And, you know, they're a mess, you know. Others have just really had a lot of what most people would call bad luck, and have lost everything, yeah. though they weren't doing anything wrong, and they, you know, they have legitimate needs. Others have just decided, you know, homeless is cool. I don't want to work. You know, I've got my friends out here on the street. I can live minimally and live on charity. That kind of person should not be supported. But of course, when you meet a homeless person, you don't know instantly which category that person may fall into. That's why benevolence ministry should make some attempt to get to know the background of people that they help. I mean, to just hand out bread on the streets, it may be great to do once or twice. I mean, in a sense, there's people who, in emergency situations, even if they're being irresponsible, you still don't want them to starve necessarily. So, I mean, if you just hand out bread to someone who you know is hungry, well, that's fine. But if you're going to really help them in the long run, it's not helping them to make them perpetually dependent on you at all. And so the ideal would be to, discover through counseling with such people, I guess, get to know them, what their situation is, and then apply the most responsible Christian response. I mean, if you find that they're not really physically unable to work, but they just haven't been motivated to do so, or they just don't have any place where they can take a shower because they don't want to apply for a job stinking and being all greasy and sweaty and dirty. Well, I mean, you can provide access to showers or something, and clean beds somewhere while they look for work. I mean, obviously, people have to be lifted up out of poverty, And that means that they probably can't, most of them can't just, you know, wake up today and say, I guess I'm going to go do everything necessary to get me out of poverty, because there are there are problems systemic in their lives. But to find out what can be done to help them onto a more responsible self-supporting lifestyle is a very Christian thing to do. And for those that are simply, you know, incapable of work because they're crazy or they're physically broken in some way, I guess helping them just like in the Bible times, they would help beggars, a beggar, but a person would not be a beggar in biblical times if he could work. I mean, it was a shame to be a beggar. I think, unfortunately, now for a certain mentality of homeless people, being a beggar is just is normalized. There's no shame to it at all. But to feel like I have to depend on other people to give me their hard-earned money so that I can eat, not working, it should be at least something we regret. I mean, we can't help it if we didn't make ourselves unable to work, then we just have to accept the fact that, okay, God's put me in this humbling situation. But it should still be humbling, I would say, I don't know what kind of policy your organization has for helping the homeless, but I would say that if it's simply a matter of handing out food indiscriminately over a long haul, then there are certainly people, probably a fair percentage of them, that you are simply enabling to neglect what their responsibilities as adult human beings are.
That's good. Beforehand. Okay. Hey, thanks a lot, Brother Steve. I appreciate that.
Okay, David. God bless you. Thanks for your call. Jeremy from Post Falls, Idaho. Welcome.
Hey, Steve. How are you doing?
Good.
Yeah, I was curious. Have you heard of the No Name Church? They're also called the 2x2s.
Yes.
I was curious if you could tell me what you know about them. I'd love to get your opinion.
Well, I don't know much firsthand. I met a couple of those guys on the street once when I lived in McMinnville and talked to them. And, you know, they seem like they're trying to follow Jesus. I mean, I couldn't tell what their theology was very much. And it just seemed to me like they're trying to emulate Jesus. But I think they've got sort of a legalistic, slightly, fringy idea of what it means to follow Jesus. But, I always am happy to see people who radically want to follow Jesus. But I've also heard from people who have had more contact with them than I have had, that they were regarded by such people as cultic. Now, of course, people could call anything cultic that they don't agree with. You know, I mean, if there was a group of amillennialists, dispensationalists might call them a cult just because they disagree with their theology. But, and that wouldn't be a fair assessment just because they disagree. But I can't remember specifically because I never got much detail, but I do remember that my first impression of them was they were a little on the fringe and might be a little cultic, but I wasn't going to judge them for it. And then I'd meet people who had been in them, who had gone to their meetings sometimes, and who don't anymore. And in virtually every case, they describe them as being cultic. But I can't, I can't label someone a cult if I don't even know what it is they're teaching or what it is they're doing that's cultic. All I can say is, I don't think I've met anyone who visited them for a while and then came out of them and didn't think of them as cultic. So that's all I know. You can find out more by contact with them. It sounds like you're having some contact with them.
Yeah, thank you very much. I appreciate that.
Okay, Jeremy. I can't be more helpful than that, I suppose. You know who might be? Hank Hanegraaff might know all about him because he's got all these files on cults and religious movement stuff. You might want to get in touch with his organization.
Thank you, Steve. Appreciate it.
Okay, Jeremy. God bless. Okay, Andrea from Atlanta, Georgia. Welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Okay, well, I wanted to get in on a conversation from 2 days ago about Genesis.
Okay.
And when I was a little girl, my mother would read me the Bible, and when we got to the part where Cain is kicked out of the Garden of Eden, he said, please don't kick me out because those other people would
kill me,
right?
Mm-hmm.
And so a few years back when I started to dedicate my life to the Lord, I read the Bible all the way through twice, and once I had an epiphany, and it literally says, before Adam and Eve were created, that the Lord had populated the earth.
Where does it say that?
He had, before the story, before he rested and created Adam, and then he said it was not good for man to be alone, and created Eve.
Yeah, before that, there were humans?
That's what it says, especially when you read the NIV version, it seems linear. He says, go, populate the earth, make them in our likeness with
in Genesis 1, 26, yeah, uh-huh, and 27.
Yeah, so anyway, when atheists ask me, you know, how in the world does Adam and Eve make sense? Sometimes I tell them, well, actually, I take the Bible literally. It says as clear as day before Adam and Eve are created that he told it, he said us, we assume he was talking to other heavenly beings, you know, go and populate the earth with men and women and animals. And then it seems like Adam and Eve are first in line of the Hebrew children.
Well, I certainly read it differently than that. I think almost all Bible scholars do. Genesis 1 does record on the sixth day that God said, let us make man in our image and let us give them dominion over the fish of the sea and the birds of the air and the beasts of the field, so forth. And so he made man and woman and gave them that charge. And then he rested on the seventh day. Now, in chapter 2, especially at beginning of verse 4, we read about the creation of Adam, and then later in the chapter of Eve. And I think what you're doing is assuming that the events of chapter 2 actually are subsequent to the events of chapter 1. I don't know any real Bible scholar, or frankly, a very careful Bible reader, who thinks that chapter 2 is describing events that followed chapter 1. The truth is that chapter 1 is a contained unit of 7 days of creation, which included the creation of man and woman on the sixth day, and then God resting. Chapter 2 at verse 4 begins to tell a part of that story in more detail. Chapter 2 doesn't begin to describe things that happened after chapter 1, but it more focuses on the events that you've just referred to in chapter 1. Chapter 1 mentions that God made them male and female. It does not say how or in what order or anything like that. It just mentions in passing, just like it mentioned in passing, he made the birds and the fish and the animals, and he made humans, male and female. It doesn't go into any detail there because the point is to give an overview of the whole week and not focus on any one thing primarily, except that God rested on the seventh day. Now, after that has been done, there's this, what we might call a sidebar. In a magazine story, a story might tell a lengthy story and then have a sidebar that goes into one aspect of that story in greater detail. And I, at least all the Bible scholars I know, believe that chapter 2 is like a sidebar. He's already mentioned in chapter 1 that he made man and woman, but he hasn't given any detail about that. So in chapter 2 he says, let me focus on that particular part. When God made male and female, he first made the man. Later, he made the woman from the man. And so I personally don't believe that we have any suggestion that human beings were created earlier than Adam and Eve. It's just that the creation of man and woman has been mentioned in chapter 1, and it's mentioned in more detail in chapter 2. But it's the same creation of man and woman. Now, I think one reason for taking it that way is that we are told that all humans came from Adam. And in the New Testament suggests that Adam brought death upon the whole race with his sin. And also, it says Eve in Genesis 3, it says her name was called Eve because she's the mother of all living. Now, if she's the mother of all living, then there weren't any other people living who weren't her children. So it would suggest that Adam and Eve were not created at a time when there were lots of other living people around, or any other living people. The entire earth was populated from those two. Now, to say they were the first of the Hebrew race, Well, of course, they weren't Hebrews. The Hebrew race came from Shem after the flood. All the other races also came from Noah's other children. So Adam and Eve were not so much the founders of the Hebrew race as the founders of the human race, which diversified into different races and nations after the flood. But the flood, the only people who survived the flood were Noah's family, and Noah was descended from Adam and Eve. So even if there had been other people unrelated to Adam and Eve in Genesis 2 and 3, which apparently there were not, there wouldn't be any alive today that weren't related to Adam and Eve, because everyone today came from the survivors of the flood. And all the survivors of the flood come from Noah's family, who is descended from Adam and Eve. So I think probably you're just relating chapters 1 and 2 of Genesis to each other in a way that isn't, to my mind, the best way to understand them. I appreciate you sharing, though. Listen, I need to take a break, but we have another half hour coming up, so don't go away. You're listening to The Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg. We have a website, thenarrowpath.com, which is loaded with audio files that are free. Everything there is free. And you may want to check it out, because the stuff, just because it's free doesn't mean it's worthless. It's good stuff at thenarrowpath.com. We're listener supported. You can write to us at The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593. I'll be back in 30 seconds. Stay with us.
Tell your family, tell your friends, tell everyone you know about the Bible radio show that has nothing to sell you but everything to give you. And that's The Narrow Path with Steve Gregg. When today's radio show is over, go to your social media and send a link to thenarrowpath.com, where everyone can find free topical audio teachings, blog articles, verse-by-verse teachings, and archives of all The Narrow Path radio shows. And tell them to listen live right here on the radio. Thank you for sharing listener-supported The Narrow Path with Steve Gregg.
Welcome back to The Narrow Path. My name is Steve Gregg, and we're live for another half hour coming up right now. Because we're live, you can call in and talk to our audience and myself if you have questions about the Bible or the Christian faith, or maybe you see things differently, like our last caller did. You can call in and say so. The number to call is 844-484-5737. Right now, it looks to me like we have maybe two lines open, so you might want to grab one of those by calling 844-484-5737. And our next caller is Joe from Seattle, Washington. Joe, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Thanks, Steve. Good to talk to you again. It's been a while. Mm-hmm. I'm in a Bible study group. We're in the book of Luke, and came across the story about Jesus raising Jairus' daughter from the dead.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it's mentioned there that after he raised her, he directed them to give her something to eat.
Yeah.
Now, I can't find any other examples in Scripture where a recently raised person was directed to be given food. The question is that an important detail?
It may be or it may not be. You know, this girl, we were told, died after being a prolonged sickness. Her father came to Jesus. The father came to Jesus when she was sick, and prevailed upon Jesus to come to the house to heal her. And before they got there, the message came that she had died. So she had been sick. We don't know how long she'd been sick, but apparently she had a very serious illness for all. And she may well have not eaten much. Lots of people lose weight during their illness. They have no appetite. And it may be nothing mystical or deep at all. It may be that Jesus knew very well that she had an empty stomach. She hadn't eaten for a while, and now she's alive. Let's, fuel her up, give her some food. That sounds maybe less spiritual than giving it some kind of a spiritual meaning. But on the other hand, it makes Jesus out to be concerned about very practical matters. After a great miracle like raising someone from the dead, it'd be quite an anticlimax to say, oh, and by the way, she's hungry, give her some food too. Obviously, raising her from the dead meets a much greater need than hunger, but On the other hand, she's alive now and she's got that need. So give her some food. That's how I would take it. But if there's a deeper meaning, I've never encountered it. It is the only miracle I know of that Jesus said that about. And even when he raised Lazarus, we don't read of him saying, give him something to eat. But that doesn't mean he didn't, because Lazarus also had a prolonged illness before he died. I mean, we don't read everything Jesus said, but it's interesting that on that occasion he did recommend that she have something to eat right away.
Yeah, that absolutely makes sense. The only other incident I thought might be a parallel, but I somehow can't connect the dots. Jesus himself, you know, after being resurrected, he's with his apostles and he asks them for food.
Yeah, he was hungry.
Do you see any connection there at all?
Well, nothing very profound, I don't. But, I mean, okay. there may be more than I'm seeing there. But I wouldn't make a point of it much if I was teaching the passage. Yeah.
Very good. Okay. Hey, thank you very much, Steve.
All right. Great talking to you, Joe. God bless. Yeah. Bye now. All right. We're going to talk next to Michael from Watsonville, California, perhaps the most long-time caller on this show. We've been on for about 25 years, and about 20 of them, Michael's been calling me. Hi, Michael.
Well, Steve, can you hear me?
Yes, sir.
All right. It was 2004 I began.
2004, so it's been 18 years. Yeah, you've been calling.
18 years, yeah. Long time.
And you haven't got your questions answered yet. What's wrong with me?
Actually, before I get to my question, I wanted to request, I know that normally you don't have prayer time, but a woman in our Bible study, the Bible study that I go to, Calvary Chapel in Aptos, mm-hmm. she's connected with Samaritan's Purse, mm-hmm. you know, the organization that Franklin Graham started.
Right, right.
And she's now in the Ukraine. She's very courageous. When they had the fires up in Paradise, she went mm-hmm. up there and helped out. So this is not her first sort of mission. But that's a very precarious situation. So I'd like to ask all the listeners to just, in whatever way that would, however one would be called to offer prayers. Her name is Cheryl.
Cheryl, okay. You know, I think I actually was teaching for Youth with a Mission in Kona last week, and I heard about a number of Youth with a Mission people who are working in Ukraine, helping refugees and so forth. And there are a lot of Christians volunteering and endangering themselves in the Ukraine. And I know that a lot of our listeners, I'm sure, are already praying daily for the Ukraine and the people of Ukraine. So I imagine that they can add Cheryl to the list of those that they're praying for, a Christian from California who's gone to, I assume, minister to those in need there.
Yeah. Yeah. She is one of the few people that come to the Wednesday night Bible study. It's average of maybe 5, 6, sometimes a few more people, but very, very small. That'll actually be
okay. Tonight. Well, yeah, I appreciate you bringing her up. And you know, I'm sure that there's hundreds, if not thousands, of our listeners that will add her to their prayers. Go ahead. What's your question, Michael?
Yeah, so, you know, after, I mean, I've learned more about the product, I was somewhat familiar with Catholicism because an old friend of mine lived right near a Catholic church, and I mm-hmm. spent some, when I was back there in 1991.
Yep. We have our lines full, Michael. Let's, if you could, just let's go to the question. Yeah.
That's the case. But I've learned more about, say, the how the Bible is interpreted or understood in the Protestant world from you than more than from anybody else. And so you might think, well, you know, why am I still? Why don't I just?
Why are you still a Buddhist?
Yeah, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that it, from your point of view and the point of view of most Christians, they can't really mix. It's like oil and water. But I found a way to mix it, or at least in my mind. And it's hard for me to articulate why, but I honestly see no.
Well, let me ask you this: do you believe? Do you believe in God?
It would depend upon what that word, what the meaning is.
Do you believe in the God who revealed Himself in the Old Testament, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and the Father of Jesus?
I'm familiar with the scriptures and what it.
Well, the reason I ask is that you've always demurred from believing in that God in all of our conversations, and yet you've always said that Buddhism and Christ are very similar. But what I've always said is, well, the Buddha didn't even necessarily believe there is a God, or at least if he did, it wasn't part of his system. And
he did not deny an ultimate reality.
Right. And so, I mean, I suppose a Buddhist would be free to believe in a God or not, but that's why I was asking about you, because you've been a Buddhist for many decades, and although you were raised Jewish, nominally, so you probably never embraced the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, really, in your faith system. Is that correct?
Yeah, I dropped out of Hebrew school. My dad was more science-oriented, so it didn't drive with the...
Well, here's the thing. And I'm surprised that this might need to be said to you again, and that is that no matter how many ethical teachings or even seemingly spiritual teachings may be found that were taught by the Buddha and also sound very much like things that Jesus said, the core of everything Jesus said is about God. And that being so, I don't see how the two can mix. A religion that doesn't need God, and you yourself personally not necessarily believing in the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, yet Jesus said that the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob was the Father who sent him and whom he came to bring us back to. That is, Jesus saying he came to restore us to the Father, like the prodigal son returns to his father. And Jesus said, no one comes to the Father but by me. Obviously, it's his intention is that we should come through him to the Father. That's the core. Now, in Buddhism, of course, it is believed that, the whole idea is to morally improve through a series of lifetimes and things like that, whereas Jesus sees it as we are rebellious children estranged from our Father. And he doesn't want us to go through many, many lifetimes. He wants us to repent and come back to him and be restored fully. That's the difference. And that's the core. That's the core of what Jesus taught. It's the core of what the New Testament teaches. And it's certainly, I'm not sure if there's even a place for it in Buddhism. If it is, it's not the core of it. Could you tell me what is it that Buddhism offers that Christianity does not?
I heard a beep. Am I still here?
Yes, uh-huh.
Okay. What you just referred to as the core, the call from both Jesus and Buddha to enter the disposition of the heart, to move away from...
Okay, but most religions have something of that too. I mean, or else they wouldn't be religions. I mean, that's what spirituality is, and it's the spirituality of humans that makes them grasp after different religious, explanations. To say that the Buddha talked about the need for an inward, spirituality, and Jesus did too. But they didn't say the same things about it. Jesus indicated that our inward spirituality is based on our repenting from our rebellion against God so that we can now walk in a relationship with God like children, faithful children, with a good father. The Buddha did not have that in mind, and therefore it's not the same religion. And I realize that you're very devoted to your Buddhism. For, almost 20 years you and I have been discussing it, and the whole time you've been trying to tell me, yeah, they're basically the same. Buddhism and Christianity are about the same. And every time I've said, actually, if you think so, then you don't understand Christianity, because Christianity is entirely different. The way of Buddhism is to do certain religious practices that will hopefully improve one's state in another incarnation, or if not then, another one after that, or another one after that. There's no real reconciliation with a loving Father in it. There's just kind of self-improvement until you got nothing else to clean out of you. And whereas Christianity is all about God made us, we rebelled against him, he sent Christ to bring us back to him. And we can come back to him by repenting and believing in him and becoming followers of Christ. And that's essentially everything about that is different than Buddhism. So again, notwithstanding whatever similarities some people have come up with, the core is very different. All right, hey, I need to move along. Let's talk to Marty from Spokane, Washington. Marty, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve. Long-time listener. I really appreciate what you've been doing for all these years. I have a very general question. I need some guidance, and it has to do with prayer. And I understand completely, I mean, the effective prayer of a righteous man. I mean, individual prayer, of course. But my question is about what your thoughts might be, or point me to some scriptures on corporate or small group prayer. It's a big emphasis now, and I know our church and many churches where four or five people, you get together and pray. Yeah. And that has always kind of, it began to puzzle me. I'm not quite sure what your thoughts are on that.
Well, you know, prayer is not simply part of individual spirituality. All religions have prayers. Hindus have prayers, you know, the Jews mm-hmm. have prayers, Muslims have prayers, Christians have prayers. And it's, you know, in each case, for many, it's a matter of, you know, individual connection with God, individual spirituality, and it is for us too. But in the case of the Christian, we are part of Christ, and we operate in his name. We are part of his body. It's a corporate thing that we in this world stand in the place of Christ, praying in his stead as a body, as a corporate entity. Yes, God listens to my prayers too, as an individual, but the church, one of the main functions of the church is to invoke God's mercy and his power in the carrying out of his purposes in the world. I mean, when Jesus taught us to pray, all of the pronouns were plural. Our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be your name. You know, your kingdom come, your will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread. Forgive us our sins. You know, when I pray that prayer, I specifically call to mind not just forgive me, but forgive all of your children for their sins, you know, as we hopefully forgive others. Don't just provide my daily bread. Provide that for all of your people who cry out to you. The more we are in unity with other people in our own sense of identity, the more we are praying according to the way that Jesus wants us to be thinking, that the church as a whole is petitioning her Lord to come and have his way in the world. And whereas I think many Christians think of prayer, when I'm in trouble, I'll pray for God to get me out. When I'm in need, I'll pray for God to meet my need. When I'm sick, I'll pray for him to heal me. When my children are going astray, I'll pray for God to bring my kids back. Yeah, we do pray that way, and we have every right to. But I think that when Jesus says, where two or more agree is touching anything, it shall be done, he's indicating that it doesn't have to be every last Christian on the planet praying for it, but more than one is, in a sense, better. The plan is for the church in unity to be praying and beseeching God for his will to be done on earth as it is in heaven. So group prayer is a very good thing. Now, my problem is many times going to a prayer meeting, a lot of times when people pray, they don't see it that way. And even as a group, they just pray for individual needs. You know, you get six people together and each one is praying for their aunt with cancer or their child, you know, who's...
That's what typically happens. That's been my experience.
Right. And those prayers, there's not a thing wrong with praying for those things, but it seems like it wastes a tremendous opportunity when the church could be gathered together, focused on your kingdom come, your will be done on earth as it is in heaven, and calling out to God as a people of God on the earth, saying, come, Lord Jesus, you know, I mean, come do your will in the earth. I don't know. There's just something, a different dynamic about in unison people praying what all Christians are supposed to be focused upon. And
some direction would be better given from the pulpit to say, let's pray now together in groups.
I think that would help. I think that would help. And I don't know
this.
Right. And I know some pastors probably understand this well and could give good instructions. I think other pastors have just kind of surrendered to the whole idea of individual spirituality, individual salvation, individual, you know, go to heaven when you die kind of stuff, that they have not, they don't have a vision for what God's trying to accomplish on earth and the role that the church corporately has in bringing it to pass. And of course, through our labors and our prayers. So I think maybe that's something many pastors need to look into. And if the pastors don't, then the Christians listening to me can. I'd love to see much more corporate prayer where the church is beseeching God for the global concerns of the kingdom of God together in unison, because that agreement.
Okay, then a follow-up question, which would be related to that, is quite often there are gatherings specifically around 2 Chronicles 7:14, which is just, we're going to take that verse, and we are going to, as a corporate body, as a gathering today, we are going to, and they're referring to America. They're referring to...
I know they are, yeah.
And so,
well, okay, that verse, of course, does not speak about America per se. If my people who are called by my name is referring to Israel in that place, and I will heal their land.
Yeah, that's Israel, correct?
Right. On the other hand, for us to pray that God's will be done on earth as it is in heaven would be inclusive of our country, too, and every other country. I mean, I would feel somewhat guilty praying only for things to happen positively in America and to leave out, you know, other lands where Christians are suffering. I mean, there's a lot of countries that probably are more desperately in need of prayer than ours, although we're in a bad way. I mean, we definitely need to be praying for all nations. We need to pray for God's will to be done on earth as it is in heaven. I don't think there's anything wrong with naming specific things that need to happen, you know, for God to remove the wicked and to establish justice and raise up leaders who fear God. I mean, in every nation.
I focus on the words, when my people, in that particular context, it was Israel.
It was Israel. The church didn't exist.
Is it that transferable that now people can say, well, we can take that and say, my people are now modern-day Christians, and whatever land it is, could be Canada, could be America.
Right. I would say that, Christians are God's people. But they shouldn't only be praying for their own country. I think that's another kind of self-centeredness. I mean, we typically pray for ourselves and our family and so forth. And if we might feel like we're becoming a little less self-centered if we start praying for our whole country. But the fate of our whole country affects us and our children and us. But what about the fate of Nigeria? What about the fate of Brazil or Venezuela? What about the fate of course, the Ukraine or Russia, for that matter? What about the Uyghurs? What about the Kurds? I mean, are their needs less important than ours? I mean, we don't know all the needs, and I often tell God that. So, I want to pray for everybody. I don't know what everyone's going through, but your will be done on earth, as it is in heaven. The idea is that we are invoking the blessing of God on the planet earth because that's what he told us to pray for, that his will be done on earth as it is in heaven. So, that would be, now, honestly, I don't think there's anything wrong with praying for America. I think America needs prayer tremendously. But if that's what we always pray for, if every time we get together, we're saying, okay, we're hoping for a revival in America. We're hoping for, political sanity and justice to prevail in America. Well, of course I pray for that, but not America more than any other place. I mean, every place is equally important to God and to the people that live there. And so, again, having sort of a self-focus will lead us to pray far more for our own. I don't know that we stand in a position of authority to pray for our own country more than to pray for any other country. Though we are a kingdom of priests and we are to intercede for the world. And that would include our own country. But I would say that if Christians are largely focused and not even thinking about anything else than their own environment and largely hoping that they won't lose their freedoms, largely hoping that their children will live in a prosperous land. I mean, I think you can pray for such things, but why not have the same concern for every nation and all people? That'd be my concern. Anyway, those are just some thoughts. Obviously, people have to work out, churches have to work out their own approach to corporate prayer, but those would be some thoughts I would hope they'd take into consideration. We're almost out of time here. Let's talk to Nelson from Fort Worth, Texas. Nelson, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Call.
Hi, Nelson. Go ahead.
I've got a question about this Revelation chapter 20 about the first resurrection.
Mm-hmm.
Is that pointing to the saints that rose from the dead at Christ's resurrection in Matthew chapter 27? This is the blessed and holy are they that are partakers of the first resurrection. On them the death has no power.
That's not what I think it's referring to. Different people have different opinions about what the first resurrection is, but I think since John wrote Revelation and he mentions the first resurrection as if that makes some sense to his readers, I'd look back at what John said elsewhere that might give some insight into what the first resurrection is. And that would be in his gospel, in John chapter 5. I'll tell you this, outside of John's writings, you won't find any reference anywhere to more than one resurrection. There's an eschatological resurrection of the righteous and the unrighteous. But John's gospel does mention, and only John's gospel does, and Revelation, written by the same man, two different kinds of resurrection. And in John 5, and let me turn there. In John 5, verse 25, it says, "Most assuredly I say to you, the hour is coming," okay, that's future, "and now is," which is present, "when the dead will hear the voice of the Son of God, and those who hear will live." Okay, so when people who are dead hear Christ's voice and come to life, that's a resurrection. But he said, that's happening now, and it's happening, it'll happen at a future time. The hour is coming when this is true, and there's also now is. Now, in what sense is that now? Because the part that's now is earlier than the part that is coming. And the part that's now, he says, in just the previous verse, verse 24 says, "Most assuredly I say to you, he who hears my word and believes in him who sent me has everlasting life and shall not come into judgment, but has passed from death into life." So he says, those who hear my word and believe it have passed from death into life. That's the part that now is. The hour is coming and now is when the dead hear the voice of the Son of God and the dead live. Okay, well, Jesus said, well, that's happening right now with those who hear my voice and believe it. They are living. This is clearly a spiritual resurrection. They were spiritually dead and they're coming to life spiritually, because he's not really talking about dead people in the physical sense here. But a couple verses later, in verse 28, he says, "Do not marvel at this, for the hour is coming." Now, interestingly, this time he doesn't say, "and now is." So he's just referring to the future now. "The hour is coming when all who are in the graves will hear his voice and come forth. Those who have done good to the resurrection of life, and those who have done evil to the resurrection of condemnation." So now he's talking about the physical bodies, those who are in the graves. "The hour is coming when those in the graves will come forth. But now those who are spiritually dead are coming to life." And that's the two resurrections. I believe the first resurrection in Revelation 20 is being born again. That's what happens during this age. And then at the end, those who are dead rise in certainly a different kind of resurrection, physical in that case. You've been listening to The Narrow Path. We're out of time for today. We are listener supported. You can write to us at The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593, or go to our website, thenarrowpath.com. Let's talk again tomorrow. God bless.